I'm starting the recording. Welcome back. Judaism and the Isms here at Matan. This is part two of Judaism's encounter with Christianity. Now, last time we discussed some theological differences between Judaism and Christianity. We focused on the New Testament. We focused on, we discussed, was Paul of Tarsus, was he a double agent? We discussed Minim in the time of the Talmud. What we're going to do now, in very broad strokes, is look at the entire medieval period and see how Christianity was understood in medieval times by medieval halachists. And then at the main part we're going to really do today is our encounter with Christianity post the Shoah. Because as you know, Christianity has changed in the last number of years. Some of you might remember Vatican II and the consequences, the changes that came about as a result of that. And we're going to see three great figures and to see what they thought about Jewish-Christian dialogue. And I'll just start with a little story, a little anecdote. A few years back, maybe it was about 2005, 2006, you had a very interesting incident happen at Yeshiva University, at YU, which is Modern Orthodox Yeshiva and the flagship Modern Orthodox Yeshiva in New York. If you were in the Beit Midrash that morning, you would have seen about 20 cardinals walk into the Beit Midrash dressed in all of their, their paraphernalia. It's a red-colored robes, and they're walking around the Beit Midrash as hundreds of young Jewish Orthodox men are studying in the Beit Midrash. And they were, talking to them. They wanted to find out what they were doing. The Christian Catholic Church has a lot of, serious troubles getting young people to join the church and becoming priests. And suddenly you have this, all these young people sitting and studying in another religious seminary, and they wanted to learn about this. As you could imagine, this caused pretty serious upheaval at Yeshiva University. We'll see what some of the reactions are. And these reactions go back to deeply held beliefs about the nature of Christianity, how close we should become to it, how much we should push them away. This was maybe 2005, 2006. Yeah, it was under the tenure of President Richard Joel. So first we're going to look at medieval... Say it. It was under Richard Joel. First we're going to look at medieval perspectives, then we'll move on to modern ones. In terms of medieval evil perspectives, you have three primary, there may be a fourth, but we're going to focus on three. Three primary views that are codified in halacha. The first is that of the Rambam. And the Rambam makes it very, very clear. Christianity is Avodah Zarah. We studied paganism. We studied how the Torah is a, in many ways, is an attack or a contrast to pagan worldviews. The Rambam sees Christianity as sitting squarely within. It's a continuation of the paganism of the Tanakh. And that means there are a number of halachic consequences. For example, you can't do business with a Christian on their holiday because they're going to do business, they're going to make some money, they're going to go to the church and say, wow, thank you for all this money that I made, and then you will be helping a Christian worship his God, and that's a real problem. So, and we'll just see in the Rambam's words here in the Perish HaMishnayot, in the Avodah Zarah, Veda, in the bold-faced words, Veda shezo ta'umah ha-notzrit ha-omedet b'ta'anat ha-mashiach, this Christian sect who claim that they're, that Yashka is the Messiah, al chiluf kitotel with its different groups, kulam ovdei avodah zarah. They are all idolaters. The idein kulam asurim, you can't do business on their aid is their holidays. V'noagim im alamachot rak kamo shenogim im ovdei avodah zarah. We treat them as if they're idolaters in the times of the Bible. And that's a very serious thing. The Rambam gives another example. In the next Mishnah, Masechet Avodah Aleph Dalid, you're not allowed to enter a city that has a pagan temple in it. Ir sheyesh ba avodah zarah chutzala mutar, heyachutzala avodah zarah tocha mutar, ma'u ledech desham, bizman shederach miyuchad lo demakom asur. You can't walk through a city or use it as a path to get somewhere else if there's avodah zarah in this the city. excuse me. The Rambam again explains that, and this for the Rambam would include if there's a church in the city. Okay? That's a pretty, It was a pretty severe prohibition. Now, we should remember, historically, the Rambam probably never met a Christian in his life. maybe, except for when the Rambam traveled to Crusader Palestine, he never lived in Christian lands. I'm not saying this would change his opinion, but it's an interesting historical fact that the Rambam lived in Muslim lands, in Spain and in Northern Africa and Egypt, but not under Christian rule. So his knowledge of Christianity is, I don't want to say it's not real, it's not real-time information. It's more of it's not based on interaction, direct daily interaction with Christianity. Okay, and some will make the case, hey, well, maybe the Rambam, if he had lived in Christian countries, he would have had a different view. And then you get into an interesting discussion about the connection between history and halakha and how these things, are they affected by each other? Yeah.
But Spain, the Catholic Church.
No, but the Rambam was in the south. The Christians started retaking back Spain. Okay, it took about a 300-400 year period. Even longer than that. They fully take back Spain in 1483, 1492 with Ferdinand and Isabella. Before that, Spain was the Iraq. Spain was the Syria where, you know, Christians and Muslims were fighting. You know, Spain was the battleground for 500 years. In the Rambam's time, southern Spain where he lived was fully Muslim. Okay? He was in Cordoba. This is the first opinion of the Rambam. We have the other extreme opinion is that of Rav Menachem Meiri, who lived in southern France in a place called Provence. And his view, which is also not the mainstream view, is as follows. When the Tanakh, when the Gemara talks about Avodah Zarah, that's talking about heathens. That's talking about uncivilized people who don't have any morality, who don't have any ethics, who are barbaric. Think of that as barbarian, the Vikings, okay? The, what was his name? That group that came across from China.
The Mongols,
Attila Hutt, Genghis Khan. It's actually a great trail in Vail. Anyone like skiing in Vail, Colorado? There's a really great trail called Genghis Khan, and it's in an area called the China Bowl of Vail. And so this is that. That's who Avodah Zarah is. He says, but the people, the Christians that were living in their midst, these are not Avodah Zarah. These people are civilized. They have laws. They don't have the same values we have. They don't have the same theology we have. It's still prohibited for a Jew to believe in what the Christians believe in, but he doesn't think that they're Avodah Zarah. They may not be fully monotheists, but it doesn't make them idolaters. They don't fit into that category. Yes?
Until the 4th century, perhaps, the Christians were actually praying in the synagogues.
Yeah.
Jews.
Oh, interesting.
It's
okay, so we spoke about this a little bit, that there were Judeo-Christians in the synagogue, and they were mostly Jews with this, you know, radical belief that Jesus was Messiah. What do you do about those people? That was last week. And then the third opinion. Yeah, say again. He did live in a Christian area. Nachon. The third opinion, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, interesting. Okay, interesting. Now, the intermediate position is that which is staked out by Tosfot. Okay, Tosfot, this is Rabbeinu Tam. This is the last source on the page here, page one. And there's a whole discussion. Can you have a business? Can you do business with non-Jews? What's the concern? You have a business deal with them, or you have a contract with them, and something has to go to court, and you're going to cause them to testify in court. And they're going to testify according to, Joe Schmo, Jesus, blah, 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 blah. And you're causing a non-Jew to testify in the name of idolatry. It's a big problem. It's a big concern. So ultimately, Rabbeinu Tam says, no, we can have them, you know, testify. It's not a problem. You could do business with them and they could testify in court if they need to. Okay, let's look at the bold-faced words. The afal pi shema shemazkirin imahem Shem Shamayim, v'kavanatam ledavar acher, mikol makom, ein ze shem avodat kochavim, gam da'atam le'osa shamayim, The Ava Bisha, okay, he's saying two things here. The first thing right here is that when they, you know, even though when they say, you know, they say God and they, you know, the sun or the blah, 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 all these things, they're really, really referring to God, as we understand, and that's number one. Also, Ava Bisha Mishatfim Shem Shemayim Devarach, even though they're combining, it's called Shituf. The Shatef Pu'ula is to join forces. Even though they're combining forces of a belief in God plus a man who became God, lo ashkachan, this is not a problem. Why not? Because non-Jews are not commanded to be monotheists. Non-Jews do not have to be monotheists. Jews have to be monotheists. But they could be, they could believe in God with, you know, someone on the side, sort of, they are allowed to do shituf. Okay? For Jews, it would be a problem. For non-Jews, it wouldn't. What we're seeing here is two standards. There's a standard for Jews, and there's a standard for non-Jews. Non-Jews have a lower standard. As long as they believe in God, even if it's sort of combined with some other figure or saint or whatever, or Jesus, that's okay. It's not ideal. No one thinks this is a good thing, but you're allowed to do business with these people. You're allowed to have, they're not fully Avodah Zarah. And even more so, because they're permitted to do this, we don't have a problem of causing them to swear. We're not party to their sin when they swear in the name of their God and Jesus, whatever it is. Okay, that makes sense. That intermediate position, different standards. The Meiri says they're not Avodah Zarah. The Rambam says they are. Rabbeinu Tam says, well, different standards for Jews and non-Jews. Okay? And Balei Tosfot also are living in Christian lands. And this type of position enables, I'm not saying that they were motivated by this, but it enables more interaction than the Rambam, for example, would have permitted. These are the three primary opinions. Now, I should mention, even the Rambam, who says that Christianity is Avodah Zarah, even he mentions at the end of Hilchot Melachim at the end of his Mishnah Torah, that Christianity, and as we'll see next week, also Islam, helped to bring belief in God into the world. And he sees them as being positive forces in the spread of monotheism. He says, we don't agree with them. But that's even the Rambam, okay, that he's able to take a step back and say, wait a second. Ultimately, they've been a force for good, for more good than bad. So that is... those are the three primary medieval opinions. Now let's move on to modern times. Something changes in modern times. I'm going to say two things change in modern times. Number one, we have something called the Holocaust. And the Christians were, the Pope knew, what was the Pope's position on the Holocaust, during the Holocaust? He said he was silent. At the very least, he was silent and... certainly wasn't helpful. And not just that, but, you know, it became clear that 2,000 years of Christian anti-Semitism, this is what it adds up to, okay? Death chambers and, you know, crematoria, okay? So the Christians, we obviously believe, are, you know, responsible. Whether the Pope himself was sending people to the gas chambers, that wasn't necessarily happening, but they were played a very significant influence over a long period of time.
And on the other hand, you have countless priests and nuns that went into the underground, or that the
correct, correct.
Many, thousands of children. Then after the war, and I'm one of those children, the question was to give them back of the enemy Jew, and that was a horrible battle.
Yes, exactly. But you also had many, many believing Christians standing at the crematoria. So they were, you know, involved in every part of what was happening in Europe at the time. And so that's piece number one, you know, recognition of how damaging, I mean, how, you know, what this amounted to, all the Christian anti-Semitism. The second thing is something called Vatican II. In 1961, Vatican II. In 1961, this was a process... and then leading into 1965, the church put out a declaration called Nostra Aetate. I'm not pronouncing it correctly. Etate, even though I did take Latin in high school. It's a declaration on the relation of the church with non-Christian religions. Originally, this was meant as a document about relationship between Christianity and Judaism and Jews, but it ended up becoming more, a broader piece. And the church changed some of its positions in a very significant way. And we're going to have to look at what these positions are. We're going to discuss whether Jews were engaged in this process or not. We're going to see in just a little bit. So first of all, I just want to point out source number one here. Yeah, from Theodor Herzl, the complete diaries of Theodor Herzl. You know, he went to the Ottoman Sultan to try to help procure and purchase the land of Israel. And he also reached out, if I'm not mistaken, to the Christians. And listen to the response he got. This is a classic, Christian position. The Jews have not recognized our Lord, therefore we cannot recognize the Jewish people. It is not pleasant to see the Turks in possession of our holy places, but we have to put up with it. But we cannot possibly support the Jews in the acquisition of the holy places. If you come to Palestine and set your people there, we shall have churches and priests ready to baptize you all. This was the classic Christian position. Okay, to that Christians are, their job is to be witnesses, to convert, to missionize towards Jews. The existence of Judaism, of Jews, was totally for them undermined Christian faith because they believed in something called supersessionism, that Christianity replaced the covenant that God had with the Jews. So any concept of the Jews as a people, as a nation in the land of Israel would undermine their theology, and so their only option is to baptize. Okay? Now, let's see what the church says in 1965. Thus, the church acknowledges that according to God's saving design, the beginnings of our faith and our election are found already among the patriarchs, Moses and the prophets. She professes that all who believe in Yashka, Abraham's sons, according to faith, are included in the same patriarchs. And likewise, that the salvation of the church is mysteriously foreshadowed by the chosen people's exodus from the land of bondage. What? Quite a bit to get through. I could try to slow down a little bit. Apologies. The church, therefore, cannot forget that she received the revelation of the Old Testament through the people with whom God, in his inexpressible mercy, concluded the ancient covenant. Nor can she forget that she draws sustenance from the root of that well-cultivated olive tree onto which have been grafted the wild shoots, the Gentiles. So this is a recognition that Christianity was, came from, originated in Judaism. Okay, go to the next paragraph. Since the spiritual patrimony common to Christians and Jews is thus so great, this sacred synod wants to foster and recommend that mutual understanding and respect, which is a fruit above all of biblical and theological studies as well as fraternal dialogues. Now they want to create mutual respect and dialogue and interfaith stuff, all this, whatever. True, the Jewish authorities and those who followed their lead pressed for the death of Yashka. Still, what happened in his passion cannot be charged against all the Jews without distinction, then alive, nor against the Jews of today. So they're not just forgiving the Jews for their claim of deicide. They're saying we should have never blamed the Jews to begin with. This is a big shift. Okay?
Wait a minute. Is that what he's saying? Or is he saying, well, you can't blame Jews today for what some of them did 2,000 years ago?
I mean, he's saying that not all the Jews, even the rules alive then, participated in
the not all. So the implication is that some did.
Right. Yeah.
The implication from this text, it seems like, is some did.
No,
but then maybe it's not the Jews. It's an individual Jew. It's an individual Jew, perhaps. Yeah. Although that you're reading it correctly, although the church is the new people of God, the Jews should not be presented as rejected or accursed by God. This is also a shift. So, so there's echoes here of maybe like a double covenant. God had a covenant with the Jews, but he didn't reject them, et cetera, as if this followed from the Holy Scriptures. Okay? There's a much longer document. Okay? This is just, you get a sense here. Furthermore, next paragraph, in her rejection of every persecution against any man, the church, mindful of the patrimony she shares with the Jews, and moved not by political reasons, but by the gospel's spiritual love, decries hatred, persecutions, displays of anti-Semitism directed against Jews at any time and by anyone.
Well, the love decries is extremely weak. I mean, it's not condemned or
correct.
Falsified. And it's used too
Okay, so we're seeing already the types of reactions that people, you know, see in something like this. Okay? And you can, you know, some of the ways that rabbis responded to this. You can imagine some rabbis said, wait a second. This is way too little, way too late. We don't even believe you now. There's no indication that we should really believe you now. Yeah, this is not a full throttle apology. This is a, you know, we should find common understanding. They haven't taken full responsibility for the Holocaust. You know, so that's, on the other hand, you can imagine there are going to be people who are going to say, wait a second, this is an opportunity. They're trying to turn the corner. Let's work with them. What is going on outside?
I think it's called recess.
Okay, the Gan kids are screaming at the Amit girls. That's the Okay, we have in the Bible, we're gonna see three opinions now. By Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Abraham Joshua Heschel, and Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. Rav Moshe Feinstein, the great American post-Hagge of the 20th century, in Yoredeya Chela Gimel Siman Mem Gimel. He's asked, can I attend these, you know, these interfaith and interfaith dialogue, rabbis and priests, you know, to talk things through a little bit? Let's look at the bold-faced words. Pashut ubarur. It is simple and clear. Shehu isur chamur. This is a very severe prohibition. Shel avizrayu devodazara. This is like almost engaging in Avodah Zarah, okay? Asher pashta ha-magefa ata b'harbe mekomot. This magefa, this plague of Jews meeting with Christians is spreading everywhere. Ayidei yuzmat ha-popist, ha-epifior, you know, through the initiative of the Pope. Hechadash asher kol kavanatohu, whose entire intention is lahavir et kol ha-yudim mei emunatam torah v'akdosha v'sheyikablu et emunat ha-notzrim. This is just a new strategy. In 2000, it's a new strategy to try to get the Jews to convert. So it didn't work trying to kill us, so now we're going to, you know, take a different path. This is exactly what Yasser Arafat did in the 1980s, you know. Beforehand, you know, terrorist attacks. And then he said, oh, you know, let me, you know, try diplomacy. But he was very clear. He was as clear as anyone could have been that his intention is to... It's not to make peace, it's to carve out chunks of Medinat Yisrael, get pieces back, and then to continue, you know, the holy war against the Jewish state. And it's just a different strategy and tactic. It's not a change in view. And it's easier to use to be nice than it is to be to try to kill us. Any engagement whatsoever is totally prohibited. It's equivalent to the Torah prohibition of spreading, you know, getting other people to engage in idolatry, which is a prohibition in Parashat Re'eh. Very severe words here by Rav Moshe Feinstein. I don't think he showed up in any of these interfaith dialogues. And it's very clear what his view is on this. And, you know, and there's a lot to be said for this. Let's go to page 3. Let's go to the other extreme, to Abraham Joshua Heschel. Abraham Joshua Heschel is a Jewish theologian who was, you know, comes from a Hasidic dynasty of sorts. A beautiful, very poetic writer. He was associated with JTS, the Jewish Theological Seminary. Dies in 1972, but if I'm not mistaken, in his own practice, he was Orthodox. He davened at a shtiebel, actually, around the block from where he used to live on the west side of Manhattan. And he extensive, prolific writer, you know, really interesting thinker. So let's see what he says. Correct. Pictures of him next to Martin Luther King, famous picture. He decided to go to Vatican II. He was invited and he went in order to engage in discussion with the Christians. Okay, so as opposed to, you know, Rav Moshe Feinstein, he says totally prohibited, Abraham Joshua Heschel engages in dialogue. And he writes an article, No Religion is an Island. I speak as a person who is convinced that the fate of the Jewish people and the fate of the Hebrew Bible are intertwined. The recognition of our status as Jews, the legitimacy of our survival, is only possible in a world in which the God of Abraham is revered. Nazism in its very roots was a rebellion against the Bible, against the God of Abraham. Realizing that it was Christianity that implanted attachment to the God of Abraham and involvement with the Hebrew Bible in the hearts of Western man, Nazism resolved that it must both exterminate the Jews and eliminate Christianity and bring about instead a revival of Teutonic paganism. So he says, wait a second. Nazism was an ideology which was against the children of Abraham, if you will, the faith of Abraham, which includes Judaism and Christians. Nazism has suffered a defeat, but the process of eliminating the Bible from the consciousness of the Western world goes on. It is on the issue of saving the radiance of the Hebrew Bible in the minds of man that Jews and Christians are called upon to work together. None of us can do it alone. Both of us must realize that in our age, anti-Semitism is anti-Christianity, that anti-Christianity is anti-Semitism. That's a bit much, I gotta say. That line is, you know... I get the point, and he's going to say this quite articulately, that we're both standing, both religions are standing up against secularism and a godless world, but to say that anti-Semitism is anti-Christianism is quite far. Yes?
Sorry, but what's happening in Syria?
Mm-hmm.
What's happening in Iraq? They have
decimated
the Christian communities.
Correct.
And they, in Europe, the manifestation of
Yeah, yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. So let's. You want to talk about the Muslim world? We'll do. By the way, the next 2 weeks we'll be studying Judaism's encounter with Islam. Okay. So though more on this next week. There's no doubt that Islam. Okay. Certain streams of Islam. Okay. Which we could argue whether they're the dominant one or not the dominant one, but they have a lot of power. Let me.
Religious country
than
the European lost completely.
You're what?
They've lost it completely. They've lost sense of most children grow up without
any identity. Correct. And that's
no religious identity.
To some degree, he's saying he would much prefer a Christian religious, more religiously oriented society than a secular, totally secular society. And that's what he's saying is where we could work together. The supreme issue is today not the halakha for the Jew or the church for the Christian, but the premise underlying both religions, namely whether there is a pathos, a divine reality concerned with the destiny of man, which mysteriously impinges upon history. The supreme issue is whether we are alive or dead to the challenge and the expectation of the living God. The crisis engulfs all of us. The misery and fear of alienation from God make Jew and Christian cry together. Jews must realize that the spokesmen of the Enlightenment who attacked Christianity were no less negative in their attitude toward Judaism. They often blamed Judaism for the misdeeds of the daughter religion. The casualties of the devastation caused by the continuous onslaughts on biblical religion in modern times are to be found among Jews as well as among Christians. On the other hand, and this is an interesting what he's going to qualify now, on the other hand, the community of Israel must always be mindful of the mystery of aloneness and the uniqueness of its own being. There is a people that dwells apart, not reckoned among the nations, says the Gentile prophet Balaam. Is it not safer for us to remain in isolation and to refrain from sharing perplexities and certainties with Christians? .. I'm not sharing with you the whole article, so there are, I took a cut and pasted here. Our era marks the end of complacency, the end of evasion, the end of self-reliance. Jews and Christians share the perils and the fears. We stand on the brink of the abyss together. Interdependence of political and economic conditions all over the world is a basic fact of our situation. Disorder in a small, obscure country in any part of the world evokes anxiety in people all over the world. That's interesting, right? Think about this. One conflict in Syria, look how much it has affected the entire Western world. Okay? Terrorist attacks and migration and collapsing economies and Iran and Israel and Saudi Arabia and America and Russia. I mean, it's unbelievable. There's a lot of truth to what that point, that insight right here. Horizons are wider, dangers are greater, no religion is an island. We are all involved with one another. Spiritual betrayal on the part of one of us affects the faith of all of us. Views adopted in one community have impacted in other communities. Today, religious isolationism is a myth. For all the profound differences in perspective and substance, Judaism is sooner or later affected by the intellectual, moral, and spiritual events within the Christian society and vice versa. We fail to realize that while different exponents of faith in the world of religion continue to be wary of the ecumenical movement, there is another ecumenical movement worldwide in extended influence. And what is that? Nihilism. We must choose between interfaith and internihilism. Stark reality. Cynicism is not parochial. Should religions insist upon the illusions of complete isolation? Should we refuse to be on speaking terms with one another and hope for each other's failure? Or should we pray for each other's health and help one another in preserving one's respective legacy, in preserving a common legacy? Listen, you know, it's interesting to think about, where does China stand on this? One can make the case that China is an example of a godless society, a society where money is God, okay? And one example that really stands out in my mind, there was a conference a few months ago of geneticists and top doctors around the world dealing with the human genome, and there's a major, major discussion, ethical discussion going on in bioethics. Can you start, toying with the human genome? Okay, now it's one thing to say, listen, this person's going to have a very weak heart. We're going to toy with that to make sure that they're going to be healthy. It's quite another thing to say, well, I really would like if my kid had blonde hair and blue eyes. And I wouldn't mind an IQ of 192 either. And maybe we'll make, my son will be 6'6". And, you can imagine where this leads to. Okay, it doesn't end. And what happened at the conference is that all these doctors are debating whether it's okay to do this and how to do it properly. And a Chinese scientist gets up and says, I want to tell you, I did this already. Okay, totally broke the norms. And again, when your only goal is to make money and power and you don't really care about, ethical restraints, so you have the creation of a godless society like the Chinese Chinese nation, and that's another example, okay, of a society not rooted in core values. Now he goes on and he says there are four dimensions of religious existence, four necessary components of man's relationship to God. So he's going to distinguish here where he thinks there can be interaction, and this is critical. Because we're going to see Rav Soloveitchik is going to make a very clear distinction between different things. A is the teaching, the essentials of which are summarized in the form of a creed, which serve as guiding principles in our thinking about matters temporal or eternal, the dimension of the doctrine. A is doctrine. B is faith. And I'm actually going to write these on the board. Okay. So what's B? Okay. Where does Heschel think there could be interaction between Judaism and Christianity? So number one we have, okay. What was number one again?
Teaching.
Well, doctrine, right? Doctrine.
Creed.
Doctrine. Creed. What's number two? Someone read number two for me.
Faith, inwardness, the direction of one's heart, the intimacy of religion, the dimension of purpose.
Okay, so we'll call it faith.
Yeah.
Okay, what's number three? Keep going.
The law and the sacred act to be carried out in the sanctuary, in society, or the dimensions
of it. Okay, law or deed, we're obviously talking about, religious law here. And number four?
The context in which creed, faith, and ritual come to pass, such as the community or the covenant, history, tradition, the dimension of transcendence.
Okay, the covenant / tradition. In which areas does he think there can be interaction? Okay, so let's go to the next page. Page 4. In the dimension of the deed, there are obviously vast areas for cooperation among men of different commitments in terms of intellectual communication, of sharing concern and knowledge in applied religion, particularly as they relate to social action. So here he sees this is a check. Okay, indeed. Okay, and social action is something that we can do together. For example, him marching with Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King was obviously was a reverend. In the dimension of faith, the encounter proceeds in terms of personal witness and example, sharing insights, confessing inadequacy. On the level of doctrine, we seek to convey the content of what we believe in. On the level of faith, we experience in one another the presence of a person radiant with reflections of a greater presence. So what is... Okay, let's keep going. I suggest that the most significant basis for meeting of men of different religious traditions is a level of fear and trembling, of humility and contrition, where our individual moments of faith are mere waves in the endless ocean of mankind's reaching out for God. He sees poetic. Where all formulations and articulations appear as understatements, where our souls are swept away by the awareness of the urgency of answering God's commandment, while stripped of pretension and conceit, we sense the tragic insufficiency of human faith. So which category is that?
Faith.
Yeah, it seems like there could be some, imagine a weekend retreat where people talk about their experience of what it's like to be, a religious person and all the different things that they do and, etc. What divides us? What unites us? We disagree in law and creed, in commitments which lie at the very heart of our religious experience. We say no to one another in some doctrines essential and sacred to us. What unites us, our being accountable to God, our being objects of God's concern, precious in His eyes. Our conceptions of what ails us may be different, but the anxiety is the same. The language, the imagination, the concretization of our hopes are different, but the embarrassment is the same, and so is the sign, the sorrow, and the necessity to obey. So, he says, okay, we disagree, here there's disagreements. Okay? In terms of the covenant tradition, it's, it's hard to say where he stands exactly on this thing. But in terms of speaking about our faith commitments from an personal, private way, he sees there's a lot of room for discussion here. And ultimately, he's sort of saying here that all religion is in many ways, we're all, it's all about reaching out to God. There's something, there's a common denominator that's shared between all of us, and we, maybe we should sit and talk about it and share it, whatever it is. This is Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. Okay, this is obviously, there's more to say on this, but this is his main, these are his main ideas. And now we're going to get to Rav Soloveitchik. Now, Rav Soloveitchik wrote an essay. Has anyone here ever read Rav Soloveitchik in his... Okay, so he wrote an essay called Confrontation. Okay? Confrontation. This is in a journal called Tradition. He wrote this in 1964. Notice that this is before Nostra Aetate. It's before this. Okay? So there are going to be those who argue, there's going to be debate about what Rav Soloveitchik really meant. There's someone going to argue, well, what he said was before Nostra Aetate. Maybe he would have changed his opinion, whatever it is. So we're going to see this article. We're also going to see some other letters that he wrote, and then a big debate about how to apply him today. We Jews have been burdened with a twofold task. We have to cope with the problem of a double confrontation. We think of ourselves as human beings sharing the destiny of Adam in his general encounter with nature, and as members of a covenantal community which has preserved its identity under most unfavorable conditions confronted by another faith community. So he says, we're like Adam. We're human beings like everybody else, but we also have our unique people, and that's a different identity which is separate from others. We believe we are the bearers of a double charismatic load, that of the dignity of man and that of the sanctity of the covenantal community, Am Yisrael. Okay? In this difficult role, we are summoned by God, who revealed himself at both the level of universal creation and that of the private covenant to undertake a double mission. The universal, human, and exclusive covenantal confrontation. And he gives an example, like his forefather Jacob, whose bitter nocturnal struggle with the mysterious antagonist is so dramatically portrayed in the Bible. The Jew of old was a doubly confronted being. Okay, the emancipated modern Jew, however, has been trying for a long time to do away with his twofold responsibility, which weighs heavily upon him. Rav Soloveitchik is saying as follows.
On the one hand, we'll say we're B'nai Adam V'Chava, right?
We're part of humanity. We're the children of Adam and Eve.
On the other hand, we are B'nai Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, V'Leah.
And these are dual identities. We're part of the world, but we're also part of Am Yisrael. Okay? And this, there's a tension. There's a natural tension between these things. And guess what? That tension is meant to be there. There's meant to be a tension. We're not supposed to resolve the tension. Okay? Now, what do Jews in modern times try to do? They want to resolve it. How do they resolve it? They resolve it by crossing out number two. We're like everyone else. We're part of... Jews, by the way, are the biggest universalists. Okay? It's very interesting to see how often Jews will go out of their way to point to the, what we share with other people and other religions more so than everyone else. It's an attempt to resolve this, the guilt surrounding this dual identity. We don't want to be different than anyone else. We're not making them feel comfortable. Da, da, da. Okay. Yes, sir. Now we get to the next point. The next point is that Reb Soloveitchik is going to make a point about religious language and theology. And he's going to say that there actually cannot be any communication, theological discussion with us in Christianity or any other religion. Because the things that we believe, we use the word God, they use the word God. But these mean different things. We use the word command, they use the word command. These are different things. We speak about ethics, they speak about ethics. These are not the same thing. We have our own internal world of language. There's no way to bridge this abyss between us and other religions. Okay, and so there can't be any sense of communication because there can't be understanding of our Jewish internal concepts when we were to share them. Okay, the logos, the word, and this is a little bit of a complicated paragraph here. Let's read through it and we'll do our best. The logos, the word in which the multifarious religious experience is expressed, does not lend itself to standardization or universalization. Exactly what Heschel was saying, where all of us are yearning for God in this endless ocean of, you know, right? Doesn't like that language. Okay, we speak in Jewish terminology, and our yearning for God is different than other people's yearning for God. These are not the same thing. The word of faith reflects the intimate, the private, the paradoxically inexpressible cravings of the individual for and his linking up with his Maker. It reflects the numinous character and the strangeness of the act of faith of a particular community, which is totally incomprehensible to the man of a different faith community. Okay? You know, try explaining to a non-Jew what it means to live al pi halacha. They're not just laws. They're not just like, you know, it's a whole world. Halacha is a whole vast world that enters every single aspect of Jewish life. It's not just, okay, you know, you have laws and we have laws. You know, your rights and we have our rights. No, it's a different thing. You can't talk about this in the same way. Hence, it is important that the religious or theological logos should not be employed as the medium of communication between two faith communities, whose modes of expression are as unique as their apocalyptic experiences. We must always remember that our singular commitment to God and our hope and indomitable will for survival are non-negotiable and non-rationalizable and are not subject to debate and argumentation. The great encounter between God and man is a wholly personal, private, incomprehensible to the outsider, even to a brother of the same faith community. It's like, what do you want to have a discussion? We're speaking English, they're speaking Chinese. Like, it's not, there's no discussion that's capable of happening here. Yeah.
I think with the Rav Soloveitchik, it's very clear, even in his books, he has Isha Lacha, but he has the lonely man of faith.
Correct. Interestingly enough, the lonely man of faith was delivered at a Catholic seminary the first time.
Really?
Okay? So we're going to, that's another piece here we're going to have to look at. Correct. The Rav is talking about two levels. This level number two, we can't talk with other people about it. They can't possibly understand unless they're really part of our community. Okay? Now, let's go to, and you'll just see some other letters here. there were other, you know, rabbis, conservative, reform. You know, I didn't mention that. I didn't quote that piece by Rav Moshe Feinstein, but he attacks very severely the conservative and reform rabbis who did join in Vatican II and did engage with the church and blah blah. So he sends a letter to this Rabbi Tenenbaum, 1962. I just received your letter. The letter is extremely apologetic, bordering on servility. The elimination of inciting and prejudicial sections from Catholic liturgy is not our problem, but theirs. Okay? You can imagine these rabbis saying, well, if you could please just take out this line from your... And Rav Soloveitchik is saying, it's not my problem. I don't care. They could do whatever they want. Okay, but we don't need to be so servile to them and beg them, please, can you just take... He says, no, I'm not, you know... A letter to the Chacham, Dr. Solomon Gaon. This is a great Sfaradi Chacham. Rabbi Nachum Mendel Schneerson of Lubavitch has commented that the ecumenical council is a strictly Catholic wedding, and it would be undignified if we were to crash the party. Unfortunately, Jewish political leaders in America possess neither a sense of dignity nor an awareness of Jewish historical continuity. Okay? Now, he goes on further here. This is a letter to the rabbinical council, the RCA. This is the modern Orthodox group of rabbis on interfaith relationships in 1964. The Jewish religious tradition expresses itself in a fusion of universalism and singularism. Again, this is the same distinction he has here. On the one hand, Jews are vitally concerned with the problems affecting the common destiny of man. We consider ourselves members of the universal community charged with the responsibility of promoting progress in all fields, economic, social, scientific, and ethical. As such, we are opposed to a philosophy of isolationism or esotericism, which would see the Jews living in a culturally closed society. Now, what he's going to point out, though, that on this level, the Rav is willing to engage with his Christian counterparts. Well, let's see what it is compared to Heschel. It's not going to be anything related to internal religious belief or experiences. Okay, let's see what it is. On the other hand, we are a distinctive faith community with a unique commitment, singular relationship to God, and a specific way of life. We must never confuse our role as bearers of a particular commitment and destiny with our role as members of the family of man. In the areas of universal concern, we welcome an exchange of ideas and impressions. Communication among the various communities will greatly contribute towards mutual understanding and will enhance and deepen our knowledge of those universal aspects of man which are relevant to all of us. In the area of faith, religious law, doctrine, and ritual, Jews have throughout the ages been a community guided exclusively by distinctive concerns, ideals, and commitments. Our love and dedication to God, our personal and bespeak an intimate relationship which must not be debated with others whose relationship to God has been modeled by different historical events and in different terms. Discussions will in no way enhance or hallow these emotions. This sounds a little Kuzari-esque. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, there's Elohim, but there's Hashem. There's the relationship that we have with Hashem, because he revealed himself to us uniquely to the Jewish people. We are therefore opposed to any public debate, dialogue, or symposium concerning the doctrinal, dogmatic, or ritual aspects of our faith, vis-a-vis similar aspects of another faith community. We believe in and are committed to our Maker in a specific manner, and we will not question, defend, offer apologies, analyze, or rationalize our faith and dialogue centered about these private topics which express our personal relationship to the God of Israel. We assume that members of other faith communities will feel similarly about their individual religious commitment. We would deem it improper to enter into dialogue on such topics as, and he goes through a long list here, the monotheism, the Trinity, messianic idea, attitudes toward Jesus, the covenant, the what?
It's everything.
It's everything. Well, one second. There cannot be mutual understanding of these topics, for Jews and Christians will employ different categories and move in commensurate frames of reference and evaluation. When, however, we move from the private world of faith to the public world of humanitarian and cultural endeavors, communication among the various faith communities is desirable and essential. We are ready to enter dialogue on such topics as war and peace, poverty, freedom, man's moral values, the threat of secularism, technology and human values, civil rights, etc., which revolve about religious, spiritual aspects of our civilization. Discussion within these areas will, of course, be within the framework of our religious outlooks and terminology. We repeat, we are ready to discuss universal religious problems. We will resist any attempt to debate our private individual commitments. That's the distinction he makes. On this level, he's willing to discuss. You want to discuss building hospitals, war and peace, dealing with disease, dealing with secularism, poverty, let's talk. But individual faith commitments, no way. Hands off. There's nothing to discuss because we don't speak the same language. Yeah.
Yeah, that's similar, consistent view with relation to Reform and Conservative. The things that we have in common, state of Israel, Soviet Jewry, anti-Semitism.
Correct. Correct. There's a little bit more.
And most of the right-wing Orthodox was very much against anything to do with them.
Yeah. He was willing to work with them on
nothing. The New York Board of Rights, the things that we have in common, we should stick together.
Correct. It's the same notion here, you know, just another level.
Practical. The practical aspect.
Correct. Now, this is what Reb Soloveitchik wrote in 1964. Does this amount to a psak halacha? Is this a religious psak? Is this guide, these guidelines? Okay? Now listen to the following discussion you're going to have in you know, as we get to the, you know, now. Okay? We're going to see a piece by Rav Herschel Reichman, who's a Rosh Yeshiva and Yeshiva University. We're going to see a piece by Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, who's another Talmud of Rav Soloveitchik. Okay? More liberal-leaning Talmud of Rav Soloveitchik. We're going to see a piece by Rabbi Mark Shapiro. So Rabbi Reichman, first of all, this is in 2004 after the Cardinal's visit. Thoughts of a Rosh Yeshiva. In the wake of Vatican II, and its call for religious ecumenism, the Rav Zatzal issued his psak. Notice he calls it psak. It's a psak. It's a religious ruling that has defined Orthodox Jewry's policy towards the Catholic Church for 40 years. He decided religious dialogue between Jews and Christians is prohibited. Social dialogue concerning human and social issues, particularly anti-Semitism, is permitted. Next page, page 6. The Rav's psak was not issued in a vacuum. He was well-versed in Christian theology and knew exactly what Vatican II meant. As a leading halachist of his time, he was also very well aware of the halachic considerations that promote dialogue like Eva and Darche Shalom and Hatzalat Nefashot, as well as those halachot that limit dialogue. Okay, we don't need to get into that. Yet he issued his, as yet unchallenged, historic psak. As far as I know, nothing has fundamentally changed in the last 40 years to warrant a reassessment of that psak. Now, thus the only halachic issue for us to decide today is whether or not any particular event is religious or social. To my mind, priests listening to Bachurei Yeshiva learning Torah in a Beit Midrash is a religious event. I would also say the same if rabbis went into churches to listen in on Christian religious classes. So this is that incident in 2004, okay? Where, now, one can make the case, one can make few things. Number one, and I'm not saying he's wrong, but there's an assumption that what Rav Soloveitchik wrote is a psak halacha. Is it a psak or is it a guideline? Okay, that's number one. Number two, one can make the case that these are Christians coming to visit our Beit Midrash. We're not going to Italy, to Rome, to sit in their church to discuss things with them. This is them coming into our Beit Midrash curious about our religion, okay, wanting to learn from us. You know, so it's not quite, you know, one can make the case that's on our terms. It's not on their terms.
Yes, but for what purpose have they come?
Because they feel that there's what to learn from us. Mm-hmm. That was the argument that, you know,
well,
someone like Richard Joel made.
Young men learn doesn't help them as much as...
No, they wanted to see, one of the things that they're interested in is how do they inspire young people to join, you know, the Catholic Church or to care about religion at all. They can teach it all they want. There's a debate about whether we can teach it to them. Okay, and that's going to come up with Rabbi Riskin in a second because he created an organization that teaches Christians Jewish thought. Okay, and there's a whole debate in the Gemara. It's a whole sugya about whether you could teach Christians or non-Jews Torah. And there's a distinction made between written scriptures, Tanakh, versus Torah Sheba'al Peh. Okay, let's see what Dr. Reuven Kimmelman writes here. He's an article in the Eidah Journal. The essay itself is quite unusual, meaning confrontation. Perhaps it can best be described via the negative, by stating what it is not. It is not written in Hebrew, the traditional language of Jewish legal discourse. There is no clear behavioral conclusion, psak halacha. It makes no reference to the history of Jewish understanding of Christianity. In this regard, it cites neither the Talmud, Judah Halevi, Maimonides, Nachmanides, Menachem Ha-Meiri, Yaakov Emden, or Yisrael Lifshitz, not to mention authorities of the last century. Indeed, it hardly cites at all. Okay? And when it does cite Maimonides and Nachmanides, the citations have nothing to do with Christianity. Finally, there's no assessment of the relationship between Christianity and Avodah Zarah. He's saying, you want to call this a psak? It's not in Pesach language. It's not in Hebrew. It's not, it doesn't quote any earlier sources. Rather than being formulated as a Pesach halacha, the essay constitutes a meditative, ambivalent reflection on the complexity of the issues. Its contradictory quality is intrinsic to its message. What it gives with one hand, it takes away with the other. On the one hand, it is sufficiently prohibitive to buttress those who are apprehensive about or willing to engage in such a conversation with the requisite religious legitimation to decline to do so. On the other hand, it is sufficiently equivocal to allow those who are well-informed theologically and who psychologically do not grovel before Christianity or modernity to broach a conversation with Christianity. So he's saying it's ambivalent. Okay? Yeah, he's making boundaries, but he also there's room for certain people to do this. It's not clear. This is a professor. It's a professor at Brandeis University. Analyzing, yeah, there's a professor. Yeah, I'm not mistaken. If I'm not mistaken, yes. But he's giving you his own historical analysis. Okay? On the other hand, it thus serves as a prohibition for the many and a permission for the few. Some will claim that the Rebbe is talking out of both sides of his mouth. Precisely, the fragmented modern Jewish situation prevents a single answer on the burning issues of the soul. The contemporary life of the soul allows for few universals. A Rebbe's answer has to be attuned to the needs, abilities, and situations of a student. By referring to himself more as a Rebbe than a posek, Rav Soloveitchik allowed himself to give divergent rulings to different students. This is well known, that he would give different rulings to different people. Apparently, the vagaries of the postmodern world preclude one from being a posek without being a Rebbe. For the validity of an objective order so often consists in reflecting a subjective reality. So this is, he doesn't think this is Pesach Halacha. Now let's see what Rabbi Shlomo Riskin has to say. I restudied in depth the moralist essay by my teacher, Rabbi Soloveitchik, Confrontation. This is not a halachic responsum. Check off for Reuven Kimmelman. He agrees with Kimmelman. It is a philosophical, highly nuanced treatise dealing with the issue of Jewish-Christian confrontation written before the church made its changes. Rav Soloveitchik was afraid that this would lead to a theological debate, and he was very much against debating issues of religion. I maintain that our center, this is a center that Rabbi Riskin opened. By the way, just a key point to think about. We've spoken about, you know, modernity, nihilism, secularism. There are those who make the case that today, with Islam becoming radicalized and, you know, threatening Jewish people's existence, you know, both in the Sunni and the Shia, you know, sides, that we need some allies. And the allies who we could stand up with, you know, if we could work with the Christians in this regard. And there are many Christians, for example, who are very pro-Israel. So there is a need to cultivate these relationships. That's one of the things that Rabbi Shlomo Riskin is attempting to do. He says we can't stand alone against the entire Muslim world. We've got to have some more allies, and that we could find those allies in religious, our religious brothers, the Christians. Say again. By Islam, exactly. Exactly. We're in the same boat. Correct. Rav Soloveitchik was afraid that this would lead to a theological debate, and he was very much against debating issues of religion. I maintain that our center operates perfectly within the guidelines of confrontation. Conventional wisdom has it that we may only discuss politics, not religion, with people of other faiths, but that's not what confrontation says. If that was Rav Soloveitchik's stance, he could have said it in two sentences, not in 25 very heavily footnoted pages of philosophical and theological arguments. Rabbi Soloveitchik is pro-confrontation. Otherwise, the other article would have been called non-confrontation. He shows in magnificent biblical exegesis that it's important to confront the world and it's important to confront the other. He contrasts single confrontation with double confrontation. Single confrontation is what Western man understands. That is that if we are to confront the world, we cannot confront ourselves. You cannot have a double identity. You cannot be a citizen of the world and have a separate unique status as a unique faith community. If we confront the Christians with a single confrontation, it will lead to a whittling away of our unique Jewish identities, and that is what Rabbi Soloveitchik was very much against. We are not one big happy family. We are two very separate and unique faith communities. What he was against was dialoguing with Christians whose purpose was to convert Jews. Debating religious issues with Christians or compromising Jewish ideals or practices to be more in consonance with Christianity. That's what he's a problem with. Oh, can we resolve your view of the Trinity and our view of God? You know, maybe we could work this out and come to some, you know, unified understanding. Those are the three things that he was against, and those are my three red lines. We will never dialogue with Christians, even on political issues, if their purpose is to convert Jews. We never debate religious issues with Christians. We only teach them Jewish theology. And thirdly, we never compromise our religious values in order to be more in consonance with Christianity. Rabbi Soloveitchik was never against expressing Jewish ideas, ideals, or practices to Christians, or listening or reading about Christian ideas from Christians. At the beginning of Halachic Men, he frequently quotes Kant, Kierkegaard, and especially Karl Barth and Uno Wacht. Rabbi Soloveitchik read and was thoroughly aware of the writings of these Christian philosophers. He wasn't against expressing Judaism to the Christians. He wasn't against hearing the Christians speak about issues of faith, which could be very revealing. He was against debating Jewish ideas and ideals. Indeed, the first reading that he gave of his Only Man of Faith prior to its publication took faith at an interfaith seminar at St. John's Seminary in Brighton, Massachusetts. So here we have a third reading of the implications of Rev. Soloveitchik's confrontation essay. We're not going to read the whole next piece by Rabbi Dr. Mark Shapiro, who's another professor in America. He just points out that ultimately Rev. Soloveitchik's view of confrontation is what became mainstream in the modern Orthodox community. And he sees this as, he laments this fact because he thinks there's a lot more that we can do with Christianity today, and that dialogue has mostly been closed off because of Rev. Soloveitchik's stance. Let's just go to the last page here, page 8. There's another thinker by the name of Eugene Korn, who actually edited this book called Jewish Theology and World Religions. He, along with Alon Goshen Gatstein, they edited this book. Eugene Korn is one of the people who's been pushing for more engagement with, he's an Orthodox Jew, but he's been pushing for more engagement with Christianity. And, you know, he agrees more with the perspective of Heschel. But he does acknowledge that, you know, as much as the Christian religion has, you know, changed its theology since Vatican II, there are still some concerning things that we do need to be aware of. And I'll just give you an example here. The Commission for Religious Relations with the Jews, we remember a reflection on the Shoah. Okay, look what they say here. It was this extreme ideology, which this is the Christian Church writing about the Shoah. It was this extreme ideology which became the basis of the measures taken, first to drive the Jews from their homes and then to exterminate them. The Shoah was the work of a thoroughly modern neo-pagan regime. Its anti-Semitism had its roots outside of Christianity. This is not true. Okay, and Korn, who's again more liberal on this, says this is blatantly false. And in pursuing its aims, it did not hesitate to oppose the church and persecute her members also. But it may be asked whether the Nazi persecution of the Jews was not made easier by the anti-Jewish prejudices embedded in some Christian minds and hearts. Did anti-Jewish sentiment among Christians make them less sensitive or even indifferent to the persecutions launched against the Jews by National Socialism when it reached power? Okay, leave it as a question. Any response to this question must take into account that we are dealing with the history of people's attitudes and ways of thinking, subject to multiple influences. Moreover, many people were altogether unaware of the final solution that was being put into effect against a whole people. Others were afraid for themselves and those near them. Some took advantage of situations, and others were moved by envy. A response would need to be given case by case. To do this, however, it is necessary to know what precisely motivated people in a particular situation. Okay, this is evading responsibility. Okay. And then they write, you know, the Catholic Church desires to express her deep sorrow for the failures of her sons and daughters in every age. This is an act of repentance, since as members of the Church, we are linked to the sins as well as the merits of all our children. The Church approaches with deep respect and great compassion the experience of the extermination, the Shoah, suffered by the Jewish people. It's not a matter of mere words, but indeed of binding commitment. We would risk causing the victims of the most atrocious deaths to die again if we do not have an ardent desire for justice. If we do not commit ourselves to ensure that evil does not prevail over good, as it did for millions of children of the Jewish people, humanity cannot permit all that to happen again. So it's you know, we're not really responsible, but we, you know, never again. Okay, this is an example of where the skeptics are right, that the Christian Church has not fully come around.
This is progressive
thought. Yes, this is progressive in a relative sense, but this is not sufficient. I mean, again, Rav Soloveitchik would still say we're never going to engage in dialogue over theological issues. But if you ask me, is this sufficient as an apology for the Holocaust? I say no. It's my own personal opinion. I say no.
He can't talk for the church because the church is divided into...
No, he could at least speak for the Catholic Church. But what he's saying is, no, I can't speak for the Catholic Church because every individual made their own decisions. But the Catholic Church...
Which it doesn't say anything about what is any pledge, responsibility. It always says humanity can't permit that to happen again.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Correct. Yes, sir. Final piece, one second, by Dr. David Berger, who's arguably arguably the most knowledgeable in this area on Christian theology and Jewish thought. We spoke about him last week. He's the one who wrote that book against Chabad. He's speaking here about a document that was written by the previous pope. What was the name of the previous Benedict? Was it Benedict Arnold? Not Arnold. Benedict. What was the name of the Ratzinger? Joseph Ratzinger. Remember the pope who? Benedict. Okay, Joseph Ratzinger, who was more conservative-minded. So he wrote in one of his books, you know, he goes back to the missionizing. They just can't get rid of the missionizing. In some, we now have an official document of the Catholic Church, ratified and confirmed by the Pope himself, and whose author is now Pope, declaring that a key purpose of interfaith dialogue is mission, which includes the message that conversion is necessary to attain full communion with God. Cardinal Ratzinger's, now Pope Benedict, vision, however, is not confined to the eschaton, meaning later on in history. He appears interested in bringing individual Jews to recognition of Christian truth even before the end of days. And he sees interfaith dialogue, though that is not its only purpose, as one means of accomplishing this end. So it's a complicated picture. And
it also omits the present Pope.
Correct. The present Pope seems to be a little more liberal. Yeah, he is. Great, he is. Okay, we're going to end here. Yishar Koach. Next 2 weeks, we're going to study Judaism's encounter with Islam. Okay, lots to discuss. Yeah, agreed. There's a lot of apologizing.